Iran says parts of its demands over the removal of U.S. sanctions have not been considered yet in the Vienna talks. Negotiations resuming on Tuesday. Russia says the West has yet to respond to its requests about security guarantees. This as the U.S. deploying more troops to Poland amid tensions over Ukraine. And the African Union condemns what it calls the wave of unconstitutional changes of governments in the bloc's member states. This is World News, coming your way live from our Tehran studios. I'm Behruz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, top story this hour, Iran saying that a good agreement in the Vienna talks on the 2015 accord hinges on the behavior and goodwill of the other parties. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says parts of Iran's demands are yet to be addressed in the discussions. He said that that will be the subject of the upcoming negotiations with the P4+1. Amir Abdullahian says that all sides will focus on a joint document in which they state their commitment to the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions. Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council of Iran has also warned that Tehran will enter no agreement in the talks that does not end the U.S. maximum pressure campaign. Ali Shamkhani says any agreement that does not remove the bans could not be a basis for a favorable deal. Meantime, the European Union has confirmed that the Vienna negotiations will resume on Tuesday. Okay, now allow me to bring in Masoud Chajer, a political commentator in London, to ask for his insight on this. Mr. Chajer, good to have you with us. So Iran is saying that the gist of all these rounds of talks and negotiations and issues is one thing, and that Iran needs to benefit from this economically. Otherwise, it's not a good deal. Let's have your thoughts on that.
Well, that goes without saying, really. The reality is that the whole sort of reasoning of this agreement originally was to sort of be an agreement which actually both parties will benefit. It will clarify the situation vis-a-vis of the nuclear environment between Iran and give assurances that it is for peaceful purposes, which Iran has always claimed. And then from other side, all those demonization, all those sort of tools which was used to sort of punish Iran for something which was the right of Iran to be removed. This was the agreement which was reached originally in 2015, and if we're going to go back to that agreement, which is what everybody claims they want to do, then of course all those sanctions has to be removed, and those same assurances needs to be strengthened and agreed and implemented. So we basically are implementing an agreement which already have been made. Nothing more, nothing less, which includes all the sanctions to be removed, and Iran would be allowed to sort of fulfill its economic sort of interest.
Exactly. Thanks for that, Masoud Chajer, a political commentator in London. Now, more U.S. troops arrive in southeastern Poland following an order by President Joe Biden. This is the latest development in the stand-up between the West and Moscow over Ukraine. Over the past few days, a series of U.S. elite forces, advanced groups, and military vehicles arrived in an airport near the Polish border with Ukraine. Now, those measures follow Western allegations that Russia is planning an invasion of Ukraine. Moscow dismisses the allegation. Also, Russian President Vladimir Putin is meeting with his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, on Monday. The Kremlin says that the crisis over Ukraine is set to dominate the talks, but it's not expecting any decisive breakthrough from that meeting. Moscow says that the U.S. and its allies have not yet responded to the security guarantees that the Kremlin has demanded regarding NATO's eastward expansion. Now, we've asked a journalist, Dmitry Zolotarev, to share with us his perspective of the current standoff, and he says that the U.S. is using Ukraine as a pretext to impose more sanctions on Russia.
As I see it, it's just another show-off from the world champion of lies, the United States government. The fact is, they just using any pretext to impose more sanctions or pressure on Russia, so they create fake allegations, absolutely not unsubstantiated, to show in the Western media that Russia is preparing to full-scale war and wants to destroy Ukraine, so on and so forth. The fact is that all those moves of the United States troops to Europe is just another way of the United States and NATO to come closer to Russian borders.
Time now for the news review. Now, the African Union has denounced the recent wave of military coup d'etat sweeping the continent, saying that military governments will not be tolerated.
Every African leader in the assembly has condemned unequivocally the pattern of, or the resurgence, or the cycle, or the wave of unconstitutional changes of government.
Now, Adieu says that this is the first time that four countries have been suspended from the bloc in a 12-month period. He was speaking at the end of the two-day African Union summit in the Ethiopian capital. The chair of the African Union Commission, Moussa Faki Mohamed, also warned of a democratic backpedaling in the continent, saying that that's not acceptable. Less than 2 weeks before the summit began on Saturday, Burkina Faso became the fourth country to be suspended from the bloc after Guinea, Mali, and Sudan. The AU has, however, been accused of double a standard by not suspending Chad after a military council takeover. Analysts also say the body must be more proactive to prevent putches. Now, let's see what our guests would think about this story. So let me invite Julius Mbello, a political analyst from London. Also, Jennifer Opeans, a publisher with the Africa Briefing, is also joining us from London. Good to see you, gentlemen. Now, Julius, tell us about the reasons for coup on top of coup after coup in African continent.
Well, on the 35th African Summit in Ethiopia, Red President of Kenya presented a report to the summit about coups, and in that particular report, he is blaming or linking the coups to political instability and as well lack of good governance. And therefore, you see, if I may, if you go to like Mali, you see a lot of protest about corruption, anti-corruption protest, and all that going on, to the level that by the time the military was taking over, people were almost on the same side as, the military. So therefore, that is an indication of how civilians, our citizens of different countries are getting discouraged because of bad governance and also the political instability. And therefore, in the end, military finds its way to come and fill up the void. So when you go to Sudan again, it's still a case in point, whereby protests for good governance, people wanted good leadership after the dictatorship of former President Omar Bashir. All these protests was about, we want change, we want proper civilian leadership, we want good governance, corruption to end and all that. But you see, again, that kind of bad governance by the former president, and also the corruption that was going on, in the end, it ended up getting the country again in the hands of the military. And therefore, you see, if there is a political stability and good governance, military tends to be, have no place to get in and be successful in
you know, leading or taking over the country. So also in recently in Guinea-Bissau, whereby at least there was some semblance of political instability by the former, by the current president, seemed to be on the ball. He seemed to be doing the right thing. And maybe perhaps that's why the coup, attempted coup in Guinea-Bissau failed. Because when no proper political instability, governments are in control, and there's good governance, there's no room for military takeover.
Okay. Now, Jonathan, Julius talked about some of the reasons, responsible for coup d'etat at this stage in Africa. Now, you let us know, why do we see some of these forces staging those coup d'etats, those kind of responsible, directly or indirectly? They are U.S. trained. I mean, what does this signify?
Yes, I do agree with Julius to a certain extent. But that's a reason of poor political governance, you know, and economic mismanagement cannot be applied to all the countries. You take the cases of Burkina Faso and Mali, right? The coups were precipitated by the rising and extremely violent jihadist insurgencies in those two countries in particular, right? Which the overthrow governments were seemingly incapable of countering. So in Burkina Faso and Mali, the rising, you know, extremist jihadist insurgencies was the actual reason, you know, causes of those coups in those two countries. We talk about Guinea. Yeah, Guinea again. Alpha Conde, who was the first democratically elected president in Guinea's political history, was elected, I think, in 2010 for two terms. He managed to usurp the constitution, change the constitution, and, you know, allow himself, you know, a third term. Okay, and coupled with that, there was a lot of corruption, and political, can I say, misgovernance, if I can use that word, right? That led to that coup. So these coups, the reasons for these coups are, if you look at them closely, they are very nuanced, you know, in each country.
Okay. Julius, so what about, what's the U.S. in this? I mean, because as I mentioned, and Jonathan forgot to answer me regarding that question, will you see U.S. Forces staging some of these coups, or they're kind of responsible for this? I mean, would the U.S. benefit from instability and no governments or lack of cohesive governments in Africa?
You see, when we talk about political instability, it's a very broad word. It covers all these things because when a country enjoys political stability, it means the leaders are in control, the government is in control. And therefore, lack of that political stability means also it creates gaps, and these gaps are exploited by people on other countries with different interests. So, for example, if a country has political stability, even the jihadists do not find their way in. If African countries have political stability and they are united, nothing stops them under the banner of Africa Union having a standby force, which can even combat if a coup is happening in a country. Send those forces under the banner of Africa Union. Let them stop those coup-hungry, you know, guys. You know, just you. It's a question of governance. It's a question of political stability, because good governance means the countries are in control and there's coordination, there's oneness, and any force to stop the coups will be there and will be failed with. Now, there's a lot of collusion between different countries. When you come to Africa, you know, African countries are, you know, a lot of military bases across Africa countries represents interest of the nations whom the military bases come from. U.S., China, I talk about even now, you know, infiltration of Russia trying to have their presence filled on the ground in Africa. And you find most of the time, whether it's Chinese, whether it's American, whether it's European, most of the time these military bases are there to serve the interests of the countries that have them there. Most of them are economic interests. Most of them are also, when you talk about war and global terror, it's happening like that. But you are right. Most of the time, some countries, some nations, when they want to destabilize other countries to exploit resources, that also that is also happening in Africa,
okay.
Whereby, you know, in terms of economy, you know, some nations thriving in crisis in Africa.
Right. Okay. And Jonathan, we have 1 minute. If you could tell us about what is expected of the African Union to do in such conditions.
The African Union appears rather less effective when it comes to these situations, because look, what they've done is to suspend these countries from the AU as a result of the coups. But like Dino said, let's take an example for the EU. We need an African High Command, okay? And again, the AU has this policy of non-interference in the internal affairs of member countries, which to me is a rather outdated, archaic rule, okay? I mean, look, you take Cote d'Ivoire, for example. The current president, Alassane Ouattara, again, he too managed to wrangle his way to go in for a third term. Whilst, the other leaders looked on unconcerned. In Guinea, Alpha Conde was removed because of what he did, usurping the constitution to run for a third term, right? So that's why the coup happened. So whilst these leaders were usurping the constitutions, what were bodies like the AU and the ECOWAS doing? So these are some of the things that the AU needs to address to forestall further recurrence or this increasing space of coup d'etats in Africa. They need to put strong measures in place to avoid these things in the first place.
Okay, appreciate your thoughts. Julius Sambello, political analyst, and Jonathan Ofe-Ensa, publisher of the Africa Briefing. Join me from London. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
To congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Economic divide.
Iran's Islamic Revolution, a revolution like no other, to put an end to centuries of monarchy. And its new political system, which was the Islamic Republic, upended the economy for the rich to make an economy that works for everyone. And that was no small feat. Hi, I'm Kavit Tahwai. In this edition of the program, we will look at the Islamic Republic through the economic lens. Coming up in today's program, a look at Iran's past and present, marking the birth of the Islamic Revolution through the economic lens, like infrastructure expansion to rural areas, which helped eliminate the rural-urban divide. We will also take a look at the expansion of health and education to the rural areas, major achievements for the Islamic Republic, how the successive Islamic governments contributed to it to lead to sharp poverty reduction. Obviously, that's something that we will look at length. And finally, we're going to take a look at how sanctions that were imposed by the West, in particular the U.S., led to indigenous manufacturing in Iran, products ranging from sectors like defense to automobile to other major fields like nuclear technology, aerospace, and medicine.
43 years ago, the Iranian nation managed to oust a dictatorial regime. The Pahlavi dictatorial dynasty was supported by the United States. The Pahlavi regime's economic policies, which were driven by windfall oil revenues and financial support from the U.S. and other Western nations, mainly benefited international companies and speculators. Ordinary people in the city outskirts and rural areas were mainly ignored. But following the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, Iranian leaders and newly established revolutionary institutions launched comprehensive programs to help the people and lift them out of poverty and despair. Iranian authorities also launched expansive programs to expand basic services to every citizen in the country. The expansion of basic services such as electricity and clean water accelerated in rural areas. By the year 2000, these services had become universal, and household amenities such as washing machines and air conditioners had expanded significantly. The expansion of health and education to rural areas sharply reduced poverty. The poverty rate fell to less than 10% in the year 2014. A comprehensive health program was initiated in rural areas to reduce infant and maternal mortality.
The IRGC's ground forces have been at the front for the building mobile hospitals. We have used these systems since 2010 in the deprived areas, especially Sistan and Balochistan province, and the southeast and northwest of the country. Today, we are launching one of the largest mobile hospitals after almost 11 years of experience in setting up mobile hospitals in different parts of the country.
It is widely believed that the Islamic Republic has been successful in the expansion of infrastructure for rural development. That has reduced poverty significantly.
When it comes to social media posts for this topic, we wanted to share with you the types of achievements and strides that Iran has made since the revolution. Now, this would be in the area of economic advancements, not only for the Islamic Republic, but for other countries across the globe. Like this social media post, which came from Ali Vargas. He said that Iran has played a key role in helping to rebuild Venezuela's economy. They've repaired oil refineries and adapted the technology to ensure that it's no longer dependent on replacement parts from the United States and from Europe. Now, a reminder of the U.S. shooting itself in the foot and Iran's valuable place that is absent from the world economy and the oil market. Dmitry wrote, "Every $1 increase per barrel of oil equals $10 million extra per day to Russia, $2 million to Iran, $1 million to Venezuela. U.S. can restore energy independence, drive prices down to benefit Americans, and bankrupt adversary ambitions. Independence secures U.S. economy, and it also brings global economic stability." And then we have this tweet from Ahmad Habib with some awe-inspiring photos that you're about to see. He says, "Did you visit Iran? This is the metro in Iran. Their economy is self-sufficient. They produce cars, buses, trucks, jets, Navy battleships, etc., despite the embargo. Cuba produced its own COVID vaccine with 93% efficacy. You should update your info. The world is changing." All right, let's discuss this with our guest. Joining us in this segment is Dr. Ali Rezvanpour. He's an international affairs expert. And we also have Hamid Ghulamzadeh, a journalist, writer, and political commentator. Dr. Rezvanpour, welcome. I'll start with you. The 1979 Islamic Revolution brought with it lots of hope for Iranians across the board. And after the revolution, there was an expansion of basic services. That was something that was noted in things like electricity and water, especially when it came to rural areas. For a young country, it was apparent that the basic needs of people were actually given the attention that it needed. How critical was this for the advancement of the country, given that the attention was given to that sector?
In the name of God, the compassionate and the merciful. As stated in the question, the Islamic Republic of Iran triumph and also the Islamic Republic of Iran victory brought many hopes for Iranian people, especially those people who were depressed by the tyranny of Shah. I mean, the deposed Iran monarch. So after the revolution, we witnessed different kinds of, infrastructure were provided for remote areas of Iran and also remote areas in which people didn't have any access to basic needs like water and also electricity. So if you wanted to just conclude the basic, improvement in Iranian infrastructure immediately after the revolution, we can refer to providing electricity and water for mostly needed people who are living in remote areas. By the victory of the Islamic Revolution, these basic needs were provided for these people, and also was mentioned by international community that the depressed people were provided with different kinds and also initial needs which were necessary for their daily life.
Okay, Hamid Ghulamzadeh, what options did the Islamic Revolution actually give when it came to the area of governance and the economy?
And when the Islamic Revolution happened, it was actually the time that the world was bipolar and we had an Eastern bloc and a Western bloc. And what Iran proposed in its revolution was a third narrative about being independent from both the Eastern bloc or the Western bloc. And it was aimed at introducing a new approach to governing a society, which was based on Islam. this was against the interests of those powers in the world, and it was important to understand that what was the situation in Iran at that time. During the Monarchy, during the Pahlavi, which was actually controlled and supported by the Americans, especially during the Cold War, in which they were trying to use the Pahlavi regime to stand against the Soviets in north of Iran. During that time, all the facilities, all the services, all the wealth belonged to the elite, a very small portion of the society which was connected to the royal family. The rest of the country were in total trouble. It included not only the villages or the rural areas, but also in urban areas. In a city like Tehran, which was an easy capital city of Iran, people didn't have even access to clean water.
It's time now for our InfoNews section of the program, where we bring you economic news from around the world. At least we try to cover economic news from where you are. First item, world economic collapse. That is what famed writer and economist Robert Kiyosaki has predicted. He has said that governments spending 16% of global GDP on the COVID pandemic and massive money printing, well, those are factors that will lead to this collapse, and that the U.S. dollar will actually become worthless as a result. Moving on to our next item, U.S. empire collapse. Yes, while we're on predictions, and this economist has predicted the rise of China that will result in the U.S. empire collapse. Ray Dalio, his name, the founder of the world's largest hedge fund firm, Bridgewater Associates, has compared political risks in the U.S. with recent economic growth in China, and says that eventually will lead to the U.S. empire collapse. Our next item, the UAE economy, it's taking a hit for its participation in the Yemen war. After the second most recent round of missile attacks by the Yemeni army, of which there has been another since the recording of this program, or since we wrote this program, the stock market in Dubai fell 2%, which is its largest in 1 month. Meanwhile, the U.S. has issued warnings against travel to the UAE. So we can see how the UAE's participation in the war in Yemen is resulting in that economy taking a hit. And our final piece of news concerns India's economy. This headline got our attention. 200 million jobs missing from the Indian economy, and the budget must address this crisis. Well, it turns out that there's a $200 billion COVID-19 related budget shortfall, and that India can fill that gap, but it needs to either bring back 200 million jobs or it needs to create that many, because it has lost almost that amount, if not that amount. So a big task ahead for the economy and the government there.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. There is no doubt that Iran's Islamic Revolution was a product of standing up to the inequality that persisted between the average Iranian and the opulence and wealth of the regime of the Pahlavi dynasty. But has the Islamic Republic been able to revolutionize its economy as well? Well, here's a comparative look at some sectors before and after the revolution. The GDP is what we're going to take a look at first, since that gives an overall assessment of Iran's economy. Now, we looked at the years 1977 and then the years 2017 for the comparative look, as we have said. And as evidence, there's quite a considerable increase from the year before the revolution up to the year 2017, $80.6 billion in 1977, $454 billion for the year 2017. Now, this one was hard to understand due to the fact, this next piece, due to the fact that Iran has experienced more economic terrorism from the West than before the revolution, when the country was under the control of the West, in particular the U.S., but this is the inflation rate that was recorded. Now, for the year 1977, then the year 2017 is what we looked at, and what we're seeing here is 27.3%, then 10.5%, practically in half. Currently, with the 13 Iranian administration, the inflation rate has come in at under 40%, but obviously that is something that is being worked on. Now, up next, perhaps one of the prides and joy of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic are the strides that were made in the education center sector, in particular the literacy rate for adults. The years 1977 and 2014 is what we looked at. The literacy rate has been one of the contributing factors behind the success of the revolution, with advancements made in a variety of fields. And here, 36.5% for 1977, then 84.7% for the year 2014. Quite an increase, as you can see. Okay, now we're going to take a look at poverty. Poverty in Iran before the revolution was quite a bit in terms of not only urban areas but also rural areas. Successive governments were aware that it needed to spread the wealth, like to the villages. The poverty rate registered in 2014 was indicative of their attention paying off, even though that rate has increased over the last few years. We're looking at 46% for 1977, then 10.5% for 2014, so quite a decrease. Of course, now that figure could be higher with the arrival of COVID-19 for the past few years, to have maybe increased poverty in Iran. Now, another feat that deserves applaud is in a sector by the name of the health sector. Health sector in Iran is one of the sectors that Iran can be proud of. This particular subcategory, the infant mortality that was recorded, deaths per 1,000 live births. Now, what a difference 1977 registering 93.3 deaths, and then 2017, only 12.8. So you can see the difference there. And this is one of the things that the National Health Insurance perhaps has done to make sure that that number has decreased to the point that it has. And then finally, along the same lines comes life expectancy, which again, pre-revolution is much lower than after the revolution. And in this case, again, 1977, then 2016, the life expectancy has risen dramatically. And this, I have to point out, is the fruits of a national health insurance. 1977 coming in at 55.8 years, and then for the year 2016, 76 years. And that number could actually be higher since we're in the year 2022. Let's get some sense out of all this, and let me have Dr. Ali Rizvanpour rejoin us for this segment. Dr. Rizvanpour, the 1979 Islamic Revolution obviously was something that Iran is very proud of, but in particular, we would like to zoom in on Iran's manufacturing. Iran is in a region where many of the countries bring in their products, imported from the West, in particular the U.S., but that is not the case with Iran. How do you think Iran reached that point? I mean, how critical was this for the advancement of the country overall?
Yes, it's a very good question regarding middle eastern countries. mainly Persian Gulf littoral states, which possess about 10 or 15% of the world proven oil and gas and natural gas reserves. Okay, and also, as you mentioned in your question, Persian Gulf littoral states are completely dependent to the United States and Western countries. They are monarchies, which, littoral states are also related and integrated with the Western countries because they do not have any industry, they do not have any production, they do not have any, facilities in order to show that they produce something. They just sell oil and gas and get, petrodollars. And by just getting petrodollars, they try to be a consumer rather than a producer. So it will affect their...
Okay, Hamid Ghulamzadeh rejoins us. Hamid, what options did the Islamic Revolution have when it came to the governance and the economy? How did it do in that regard? What was different about it?
By domesticizing such things and making those sciences indigenous, Iran has actually tried and is becoming successful in nullifying the sanctions and its impact on actually the Iranian economy. It is not something that the Americans would like, and they would stand against that. But the point is that so far, for reviewing for more than 40 years since the revolution, you can find out that Iran has proved that how unpowerful the Americans are. Actually, Iranians have shown the paper tiger that the America is, and it is not able to stand against Iran. If they could attack Iran, they wouldn't hesitate even a single moment to do that. But the point is that they are incapable of that.
Iran has achieved major breakthroughs in different scientific and high-tech sectors. Its various scientific institutions and universities have managed to explore areas which were exclusive domains of Western countries. One of them is space technology. Late last year, Iran launched a rocket with a satellite carrier bearing three research devices into space. Over the past decade, Iran has sent several short-lived satellites into orbit.
For the first time, we have had the 500-second performance of the second phase engine in space and in vacuum. The Seymour satellite carrier increases our payload weight that can be launched approximately from 50 kilograms to 250 kilograms and doubles our height that can be reached from 250 kilometers to 500 kilometers. And compared to previous generations, this is a great achievement.
In 2013, it launched a monkey into space. Iran has also managed to make scientific achievements in civilian nuclear technology. Western countries, led by the U.S., have tried to make Iran's nuclear program controversial. They've accused Iran of seeking nuclear weapons. But the fact is that Iran's peaceful civilian nuclear program has been devised to fulfill much-needed energy needs. Iran has said that it wants to build a network of nuclear power plants with a capacity of 20,000 megawatts to enable it to export more of its bountiful oil and gas. The technology is also used in the field of medicine to cure different types of ailments like cancer. Iran has also made significant breakthroughs in the field of medicine. Iran is now a leading country in the production of COVID vaccines.
Within the past few years, very good things have been achieved in the domain of vaccine production in the country. This year, we have several corona vaccines to be mass-produced. This vial production line is a very important infrastructure for other companies that are developing the vaccine.
When the pandemic started back in 2019, several Iranian research teams and institutions started research to develop the vaccine. Iran is among a few West Asian countries capable of developing and producing vaccines. The Islamic Republic has developed several vaccines against COVID-19, including the Coviran Barakat, Razi-Cov Pars, Nura, and Fakhra.
When it comes to marking the Islamic Revolution's birth, it's noteworthy that it was not just a political revolution, but also one in which Iran's economic roots were revolutionized. In terms of the significance of the Islamic Revolution, it stood up to imperialism and colonialism. It was a national movement which maintained political independence and sovereignty. But how do you create a movement that is self-reliant with the aim of maintaining its hard-won independence and sovereignty? This may have occurred in 2005. It became known as the Vision 2025. The government realized that it needed to move from a resource-based economy to one based on knowledge. This meant that it wanted to focus on human capital to create wealth. So, you have the Vision 2025 on the one hand, and then came another push to strengthen Iran's shock to external factors. It was called the resistance economy. In February 2014, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei introduced what he called the economy of resistance. This was an economic plan promoting innovation. The resistance economy doctrine was to make the Iranian economy resistant to all external economic shocks. This included Western sanctions and global financial crises. It also set out an agenda to diversify Iran's oil-reliant economy. Iran now produces a wide range of manufactured goods like automobiles, electric appliances, telecommunication equipment, industrial machinery, paper, rubber products, steel, food products, wooden leather products, textiles, and pharmaceuticals. This graph clearly shows the way that sanctions affected the Iranian economy. When Obama tightened sanctions on Iran and when Trump withdrew from the nuclear deal and reinstated sanctions, Iran knew, way back from 2005, the effects of the West push for regime change through economic strangulation, in which its best tool was sanctions. So, let's be clear about one thing. Iran's leader just recently said sanctions should not be tied to Iran's economy. The leader cited the example of economic enterprises that have not tied their operations to the removal of sanctions, adding, Iran's economy should not be contingent on issues over which officials have no control. And that's the end of this segment of Economic Divide about the Islamic Revolution anniversary.
It was a revolution that has been praised, and at the same time, it's called one of courage. The Arab Spring or Islamic Awakening revolutions, remember them? They swept the Arab world. Well, they were inspired by this revolution. Many have said that. And at the heart of all the uprisings lied one huge incentive to make people rise up against establishments. Well, Iran has proven that it cannot only withstand U.S. economic terrorism against it, but that it can break away from the Western-dominated economic and financial system and then create its own wealth. The Islamic Revolution brought that for Iran. That does it for this edition of the program. For me, Kaveh Tahweh, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir la'in rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, the commander of the faithful, and his perspective on human rights. Before Amir al-Mu'mineen attained rulership, or Khilafa as they call it, it was likely that the Umayyad government might be converted into a kingship. Rather, it had already been so converted, because we know what Muawiyah did, and he made his son Yazid a king, and he became a king himself, and then became a kingdom. The rulers and other people at the helm of affairs were of the view that the Khilafah was their special right, and only they were entitled to it on account of their belonging to the noble family. In order to strengthen their hold and establish a firm government by considering all unlawful acts like tribes, like tribal biases, formation of groups, bribes, etc., etc., to be lawful, according to them, a ruler was the master of the life's property and honor of the ruled, and could exploit them in any manner they like, without the oppressed people having the right to protest. And sadly, they viewed the common people as a quadruped who they could load in the heaviest burden and beat as much as they wish. Well, obviously, that's what they did. During the time of the Umayyad, of Uthman and the Umayyad government, so the demise of Uthman and the beginning of the Umayyad government, the Umayyad governor got an opportunity to do despotic rule, and they availed it to their heart until their hearts were content. They endeavored to strengthen their Umayyad rule in all parts of the Islamic territories. They bribed the sheikhs and dignitaries of the Arab tribes heavily to win their support. So the Umayyad dynasty, because Uthman himself has given them too much power, they were trying to buy tribes and the tribe leaders to strengthen the Umayyad rule. And obviously, they were doing that just so they could become rulers, so they can rule the life of other people. So they also bought arms forces by giving them excessive wealth and promising them high offices. And in fact, the people could not oppose them, because whoever did was beheaded or killed. So they were using that by power. Now, power itself, it was meant to be a service for people. When Ali alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful, attained the Khilafah, the conditions were very precise. The people were divided into two groups. The persons belonging to one of those groups were prepared to lay down their lives in support of the pious and just Imam. The other group supported Bani Umayyah and endeavored to strengthen their government and kingdom. Bani Umayyah obviously had also been endeavoring for years to establish their rule since the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa'ala. However, with Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he was not there to increase his own popularity, nor was he seeking power, nor did he want to become a king. He was an imam appointed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, whether they elect him or not. But his aim was to help and serve the people. Bani Umayyah's point and their aim was to rule and become unfair and unjust to people, which is a quite different than that of Amir al-Mu'minin's view. Let us take a break and then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We said Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, when he attained power, he lived in a very divided society, that a group which supports Bani Umayyah and a group which support him. Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he could not sit and tolerate that people should be oppressed. And he sits in his house when the poor citizens and the poor Muslims were being subjected to oppression by Muawiyah and the likes. A brave and steadfast person like Ali alayhi salam could not let the Muslims fall a prey to the atrocities and the wolves of Bani Umayyah and remain silent, because Muawiyah from time to time, he used to take his army and attack the nearby cities and villages in Iraq which are close to Syria. And some of these cities, they didn't even have Muslims, they had some Christians. And when the news used to get to Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, he used to be very upset. So the Imam saw it as a duty upon him to go fight Muawiyah. So when he went to Safin to fight Muawiyah, it wasn't a fight or a battle for wealth or rulership or who is the Khalifa. It was simply a fight for the right of people, for the right of society, for justice, for equality, for fairness, and so on and so forth. So Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi had to come forward. If he had not come to the rescue of the Muslims at that moment, he would have been treated to be a coward and not the brave and valiant person as known throughout history. It is his bravery that made him known through history for standing for truth and justice, not the muscles, not the sword. It's the will behind the sword. They said that Harun al-Rashid one day was looking for the sword of Amir al-Mu'minin, and they went across all the land and they could not find it. A person came to him, he said to him, "Why do you want the sword of Amir al-Mu'minin?" Harun al-Rashid said to him, "Well, that sword that killed the brave men, the bravest of the Arabs were killed by the sword, I want to hold it." And a man said to him, "Listen, it is not the sword, it is the hand behind the sword. It is the will of Ali alayhi salam to stand up for justice, to stand up for the right of man, to stand up for equality and equality and quantity of people, equity and equality of people. Not just the sword itself, it's not a skill of fighting. In fact, it's the skill of standing for those who are weak and those who do not have anyone to support them." He himself said, "I was worried and alarmed lest the foolish and wicked person should come to the rule of this nation and make the property of God their own plaything and the creatures of God their own slaves and fight with the righteous and make the tyrants their helpers." He himself said these words, "I am alarmed. I don't want them to turn the servants of Allah, the creatures of Allah, into servants and their property into their plaything, where they just have fun with it." And if you read history, this is exactly what Bani Umayyah did. They turned people into slaves to the extent Yazid, may Allah curse him, when he became a ruler, he went to Medina, he looted the city of Medina, they committed heinous crimes, they killed hundreds and thousands of people, they raped hundreds and thousands of women, and then Yazid made them swear an oath that they are nothing by his servants. This is not something Ali alayhi salam would stand for. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.